amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. and I'm here with Steve D. We're recording this on January the 18th, which isn't quite a week since our last show, either since it was aired or since we recorded it, actually. But there's been so much going on that we figured there was enough to talk about and plenty to get on with, because it's been a really interesting not quite a week in the stock market. Steve, how are you? How have you been over the last, well, 5 or so days since we last saw each other?
Not too bad, I don't think. I can't really think of anything significant that's really happened. I've been getting some good reading time in, but I'm not reading anything that's... Well, I am reading something that'd be of interest to people. I'm reading Taleb at the moment, so I'm reading the Black Swan. But I've been putting it to one side because I've been reading a book that was recommended to me called The Lies of Locke Lamora. It's a fiction book, and I've just found it really, really interesting. And it's kind of one of those things where Taleb is a very, very interesting writer. If you've not read any Taleb books, I highly recommend him, even if the subjects sound like they might be boring. He really brings them to life. But this other book has had me captivated I very rarely read fiction stuff. Unless there's something that's been highly recommended. This has, and I got about 12 chapters in, and I ordered the rest of the series, so I'm looking forward to reading the rest of that. In terms of my portfolio, Steve, doing really well today. Doing really well this week, actually. I think most people are having a fairly decent week. I've had a pretty dodgy yesterday, where I think I was down about 1.4%, something like that. But I'm already back up 1% today. I've had some pretty decent movers, mostly sort of driven on by TSMC's stronger than expected report and fairly decent outlook has meant that ASML for me has jumped about 4%, and VAT Group has jumped about 2.6% as well, and they're fairly decent positions in my portfolio, so they're dragging me along, as well as my Amazon and Google positions, which very, very rarely seem to go down. I mean, Amazon today up 1.21%, Alphabet 1.56%. That's, I've got 20K in those two positions, so that is a fair old drag along for me. But doing pretty well, Steve. How about you? How's your week been? How is your portfolio doing?
My portfolio is doing less well. Taleb's really interesting, by the way. I really like his stuff on anti-fragility because I think it's kind of wildly misunderstood sort of all over the place. I mean, his point is that there are things that are robust, which is to say they stand up to pressure, things that are fragile, which is to say that they don't, and things that are anti-fragile, which is to say they get stronger under pressure, basically. So they're the opposite of fragile. And nearly everyone that I've seen talking about it seems to confuse being anti-fragile with being robust, which is to say fine under pressure, and maybe robust is relatively strong under pressure compared to fragile, but by itself, it's mostly just gets hit less than fragile stuff. And everyone I hear talking about anti-fragility seems to think it's a desirable characteristic. And I don't think it is intrinsically anyway. I mean, the point of being anti-fragile is you're not that good most of the time, but when stress comes on, then you really excel. So a good example of something that's anti-fragile, it depends what kind of stress you're talking about, but a good example of something that's anti-fragile is something like a credit default swap, which is rubbish when everything's going well. But when people start defaulting on their debts all over the place, that thing goes through the roof. So that's anti-kind of fragile. It's probably good for diversifying your portfolio. It's probably good for hedging. It's good for a whole bunch of stuff. But the idea you would go and hunt down stuff that was anti-fragile and try and build a portfolio full of anti-fragile stuff is mysterious to me. I can see that maybe you might build a portfolio full of robust stuff, which you think, actually, if the heat comes on, we're going to be okay here, and maybe that will allow us to take share from our rivals who are not going to be okay, or something like that. I think of sort of JD Weatherstones in that category, as if everyone starts trading down, they tend to do better, but it's not good for them, a kind of crunch on these kind of things. But anyway, I've not been reading Taleb. I just thought I'd reflect on my thoughts about anti-fragility, because It seems to me that everyone gets it confused. But anyway, it's been the first week of term here. So naturally, we're on Thursday. So I've only been in term time work for 4 days, which is long enough for me to be just slightly behind from where I'm supposed to be, because that's the nature of term time. Monday and Tuesday were fairly quiet days. Wednesday was insanely busy. Today was insanely busy, and I'm now behind. I will catch this up at some point between now and the end of term. There's not a worry at this stage. There's loads of time to catch all this stuff up. It's still quite a nice feeling. Students are pleased to be back. I'm reasonably pleased to be back teaching them. It's nice teaching them when they're not tired and quite enthusiastic and so on. So that's all going all right. Portfolio wise, I've been busy underperforming stuff. I looked today, and over the last week, so last 7 days, which means that based on what I reported last week, I am double counting last Friday as part of both the week just gone and the week that was just gone when we last recorded. So double counting in there, this isn't strictly a week over week thing. I'm down 1.8%. The S&P 500 is down 0.something%. And the FTSE 100 is down 1.5%. So why is the FTSE going down and why is I going down? The short answer is inflation, as far as I can tell. So we had inflation reads from the UK and the US, and I'm not terribly surprised at the UK one that seems to have caught people by surprise. The UK one came yesterday, and the news is that inflation was at 4%, which is up from the 3.9% the last reading was, but still lower than the one before that, which was around 4.6%. So the reason this has been, it's down, by the way, from 6.7% in September, which is only roughly a quarter ago, a fraction more than that. So, still coming the right way if you take a sort of broader look, but not coming down in a straight line or anything like that. The main reason for this, I think, was an increase on tobacco duties has pushed up the CPI basket. I'm kind of unclear as to whether I think that has a massive societal harm, that level of inflation. If the price of other stuff, I worry more when it's in stuff like food, put it that way. Tobacco prices going up, sure, that will drive up the cost of living for some people for whom, and I can't believe this is a genuine sentence that I'm about to say, or a property that I'm about to ascribe to something, smoking is an important part of their living. It kind of feels weird saying it, but if that's the case for some people, yes, their cost of living will go up. And maybe that's enough people for it to be a representative part of the CPI. I don't know. I'm not taking a judgment on that. But if that's the main driver of inflation, I'm kind of unworried from a societal perspective. Where I think that's more interesting is the way the markets have reacted to that, which is, as far as I can tell, to have a giant panic and undo a lot of their previous optimism gains. And as a result, I like the stock market a lot more now than I did a week ago, because I thought a week ago the market was pricing in rate cuts that I thought were, in some cases really quite optimistic, and I don't like it when prices are pricing in things that I think look optimistic. It makes it harder for me to buy them. In some cases, they were clearly pricing in as early as February for a rate cut, which I thought was kind of beyond optimistic and I thought was slightly ridiculous. But even April, I thought there's still stuff that price is reflecting that things are going to go right from here. It's reflecting the idea the Bank of England is going to cut rates several times this year and start fairly soon. And I'm not sure where the upside is when we start pricing for optimism here. This has kind of put the brakes on that idea a little bit. And I think in certain corners of the market, we're now pricing for pessimism. We're now pricing for, oh no, they're not going to cut rates all year. Also, we're going to have interest rates higher forever. And that is a situation where I think prices look like something I can get behind and start buying things again. So I made a couple of moves that happened to have been at the right time. But nonetheless, my portfolio in general in the ISA is under both FTSE 100 and the S&P 500 for this week. So I'm feeling okay about life, but down a bit as a result of that inflation read. Steve, did that surprise you that inflation came in slightly higher than its previous level?
I don't really try to predict these things, so I'm never really surprised either way. I guess I was surprised by some of the numbers we got, at the heights. Because some of those were pretty shocking, and you were just hoping that they could come down as fast as possible, really, because you can't take 10-15% inflation for much longer than a few years before you sort of worry about the people who are just about managing, being able to just about manage. One of the things that did sort of shock me, Steve, was Sky News. I was just desperately trying to find it then as you started talking about inflation, and I have managed to find it. They have a spending calculator up, and for whatever reason, they have picked these items as the things that they will inform you about inflation. So they have picked 250 grams of butter, 500 mils of olive oil, 4 pints of whole milk, a kilo of carrots, and a pack of hand-rolling tobacco as their list of five things that they would like to tell you about inflation. You're like, hell, what are they making? That is a strange old concoction of things, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, surprisingly, olive oil up 45.7%, carrots up 34.5%, tobacco up 23.7%. When you see numbers like that, it's not that difficult to see how you can eventually get to 4% by adding in a few more things into a shop. So, yeah, there's definitely some interesting things going on there. In the US, is it as shocking? I don't know. A lot of people have sort of missed the point about American oil this year. A lot of people are looking at the Saudis and the Russians agreeing to these like barrel cuts and thinking that that was going to drive the oil price up. And all that's really happened is America has just produced just barrels and barrels and barrels of oil. They've produced millions more barrels of oil than the Saudis and Russia ever have. In an annual period this year, so they really are the US this year has been the biggest producer of oil in the world. So for people who think that Trump's gonna get in and get America pumping oil and things like that, I'm afraid Biden's already done the work. So yeah, that was the only thing out the whole thing that was particularly interesting to me. I mean, the US making essentially a fifth of the world's oil this year, Steve. Did you see that happening this year?
I didn't see that. I did see that Buffett and Berkshire have been buying Occidental like crazy, again, exercising warrants as best they can for this stuff. And Occidental has, as far as I can tell, and it's not a stock I know in any great depth, but two things going on. One is a big carbon capture operation, and the other is a big, big presence in the Permian Basin, which is US shale. Work out what you think the outlook for that looks like. I'm not particularly an expert, but if US oil is on the rise in terms of volume anyway, even if it's kind of holding steady in terms of price. But I'm not massively surprised, but I suppose I kind of clocked that from large amounts of Berkshire buying of Occidental. That said, they've been selling Chevron, so it's not an all-out bet on oil, I guess.
When we did the sector, when we were looking at the best sectors just a couple of weeks ago, oil came up a lot as people were rather bullish on the sectors. And I always sort of tend to think it sounds like the wrong year to have been bullish. It sounds like last year was the year to have been really, really bullish, unless America plans to keep up this huge outflow of oil from their wells, which, you know, I would never have assumed America had the sort of capability to be able to do this and then to keep it up long term. It's also be interesting to see and have a pick through these oil companies, these majors, and just see what the reserves are like on these wells and see if maybe they could potentially, you know, keep this up. Because it is a definite change in the way that, you know, in the order of things. It's definitely in the my incredibly poor thinking of the you know, the sort of oil superiority ladder. I didn't realize America still had the potential or ability to do this. I think one of the things that people were worried about with globalization is that stuff like this just gets shelved onto other countries because it's a particularly sort of carbon intensive thing to do. So if you pass that down the chain to, you know, a different country, that becomes their carbon problem. Even if you import all the oil in and burn it all, you know, keeping people warm, it just seems to be a way of sort of passing your responsibilities onto other countries. So yeah, interesting to see that America has really taken the lead here. And I don't know, Steve, in my head, when commodities are having such a good time in terms of, you know, the use like they are right now, I always wonder whether it's a good time or probably a time to get out. What do you think?
I thought coming into this year, oil was not one of my sectors to be bullish on energy was, but I thought this was going to be a better year for green energy than we've seen before. And the reason for that was because I thought inflation comes down, interest rates come down. Those two things make construction costs, which is the big outlay with building a wind farm or a solar plant or anything like that, a lot lower. Basically, if you need to borrow the money, it costs a lot less when interest rates are lower, and the materials cost a lot less when inflation is lower. And it's January the 18th, so I'm not about to declare defeat on that just yet. But inflation isn't quite coming down in the rate I thought it was, either in the UK or the US. The reason I wasn't surprised by the UK read, by the way, is because last Thursday, so a week ago today, the US reported inflation and they were at 3.4%, up from 3.1%. Kind of sticking the boot into people who were saying, oh, the Fed is far too late in cutting rates here. I mean, maybe from the point of avoiding a recession, but they're not into target range yet. And inflation clearly isn't entirely under control. They were very wrong, but they're still struggling with the transitory thing, basically. So when I kind of think about that, I still think that, but I think that's one to play out over the course of the year, that I like green and renewables projects rather than oil companies. I mean, I expressed this, I think, in writing through a very limited thought, which was that I preferred BP over Shell for this year. BP is driving hard at green energy investments, and Shell is driving hard at dividends. Maybe Shell will change their mind if rates come down and inflation comes down, right? So maybe they are just sitting tight and saying, that doesn't make sense at these prices. I don't think there's a good return in that, and I can't think of anything better to do. So we'll dividend it out and buy back with it. And hard to argue with that policy, really. It doesn't mean that if you have cash because oil prices are high and you can't find something intelligent to do, that you go off and do something dumb with it. That's not a thing. If you really can't find anything to invest in that is useful to you, then buyback or dividend or both, depending on what you think, yeah, the kind of value of your share is, and so on at the moment. Steve?
Do you think there's any credibility in the rumours of Chevron and Shell looking at acquiring BP? I mean, these are the kind of stupid acquisitions that tend to happen at very high prices right at the top of a cycle, and you're normally left with a commodities company pretty much holding the bag for a couple of years. They do tend to get a bit excited around sort of periods of growth. But is there any credibility in that, Steve? I'm on the fence about Shell buying BP. I'm not entirely sure it would be allowed, but if Shell and Chevron came knocking at BP's door, I reckon the UK government would push them towards Shell rather than Chevron. What do you think?
Chevron, I don't know. I don't know in either case. Chevron, I don't really have an idea about acquiring BP. Based on what I just said, I kind of got to the conclusion when I thought this through that Shell and BP appear to just have fundamentally different ideas about what they ought to be doing at the moment, and therefore trying to merge the two just looks like a recipe for either arguments or one side completely capitulating with the strategy it's been going on. And I don't see either of those as particularly plausible, so I suspect a merge is unlikely. I mean, it's not impossible, and it might well be the case that the bigs in the US are getting proper big, aren't they? I mean, we talk about oil majors, but not every major is the size of every other major here. They're all bigger than the other stuff. But the way things are getting rolled up stateside, again, by the way, it's not, it is so long ago that we were busy spinning out things from Standard Oil, but we had a kind of spin out and then roll back up again process. I sort of wonder in this case whether you might see either one being a target. I'm not sure. I think Shell is probably slightly too big and BP is slightly too undesirable, is my instinct with these. Whether or not that will get proven correct, because anyone will say anything, is a whole other question. But I'm not convinced I see it as an M&A opportunity here, particularly.
No, I think I probably agree with it. I think it's too difficult to acquire. I think it's one of those British assets that the government would probably like to see at least sort of onshored in Britain. So I'm unsure whether they'd want to let Shell and BP merge, because that just makes one really sort of big conglomerate in the UK, doesn't it? And I'm pretty sure they won't be that excited about Chevron coming in, taking BP, gutting all the green services, gutting a lot of the staff, and just concentrating on producing oil. I'm pretty certain they won't like that either. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's an interesting one, Nassim. It's one of those stories to follow if it starts to happen. I do wonder where it would end up.
I agree. Let's keep an eye on that one going forward. So from the government's perspective, if you're unsure, keep it onshore. Great. So this brings us to, I guess I've been talking, this came out of my discussion of my portfolio and why I think it's been going down and how I like share prices much more now than I did a week ago. But let's talk portfolios then, because we had a question, I think. We had a couple of questions from the same person. But we've got, you're starting off with the first one here, Steve.
The question came in from Investing Tortoise, and we accidentally answered one of the questions. It was, why do we choose to invest in individual stocks rather than a total world index fund? We have answered that one before. I'll put it in the end of this segment for people if they want to go on to read that one. But the beginning of the question started off, what's your biggest winner and loser in your portfolios? So we thought this was a fairly straightforward one to answer. So we've had a dig around and I've looked in both portfolios for you as well, just to make sure that you get a comprehensive answer. So for me, in the capital incinerator pie, I've got a few stocks that are over 100%. Axon Therapeutics was one. Elastic was another. Duolingo is also over 100%. But the winner, the one that's quite far out in front for me in the capital incinerator, is MongoDB. That's up 146%. It's a stock we've covered on here a few times. It got down quite cheap over when tech was falling a couple of years ago, and we did a few pieces on it just to try and emphasize that this was quite a good stock. And from that point, it's gone up quite a bit. Fiverr is my most down in that portfolio, because that's another one that we've done a few things on, thinking it was a pretty decent stock, and that has not worked out. That is down 75% at the moment. So flipping to my other portfolio, the main portfolio, the one I pretty much focus on, I fear Steve and I are going to have very similar answers here, but top of my pack is Southern Copper. That's up 112%. That's been a perennial winner for me. It's always, I think it's very rarely under 100% up. My biggest loser has actually happened over the last couple of days, because it's continued falling back to, I think its PE is about 10 now. And we were excited its PE being 16. But my biggest loser is Kerin. And it is currently down about 26%. And it's not 26% worse of a business than when I started buying it. So yeah, there's two things I'm tempted to do with that position, and it's add to it, or sell it completely and buy LVMH, because that's come down quite a bit with it. And I think it could be an opportunity to buy some real quality. With Kering was affordable quality for me, but I think LVMH is the real, real top stock in the sector. So I'm in and are in, or having them both, Steve, and taking a risky bit of exposure, because I've got some cash. I could technically do that, have a similar size position in both, and then maybe look to take Kering out if it was to return, or maybe half both of those positions and have them as a basket in the luxury sector. It might be an interesting way to play it. Still thinking about it, to be honest with you. Every time anybody mentions LVMH, that thought comes back into my head of maybe I should. But yeah, not sure, Steve. How about you?
Picking up where you left off, anything cyclical is not having a great time at the moment, share price wise, is it? I mean, these are kind of discretionary things. People need clothes, yes, they don't necessarily need those. So it's a really interesting time to be, I think, adding exposure in general there. So when you were kind of umming and ahhing about strategies, I was thinking in your shoes, if you have cash available, I'd be sticking it into that. And when those things, I think it's when rather than if in these cases, when those things tend to get back to levels that you think are perhaps a bit more reasonable, or maybe even a little bit optimistic, I think there's plenty of time to get money back out of them at that point. But I quite like the idea of having both of those as a kind of diversified bet on a gradual or eventual, probably inevitable, cyclical recovery. There are a couple of stocks I'm looking at from my own portfolio, from my perspective, a similar kind of move. I might talk about some of those a bit further down the line. But in my case, my biggest winner is my second largest position, which is Citigroup up 0.1. Citigroup is up 0.1%, which hasn't been up for ages. But it's not my biggest winner. My biggest winner is indeed from any portfolio, Southern Copper. It's actually my ninth largest thing. I'm up 74% on this because I've bought it more recently than you have. And I don't know whether I'm proud of myself for buying it or not. I think I probably rather have... I'm glad I did, I think, because it's higher than it was where I bought it. I'm up in general, and I'd rather have a 74% return on more money than I could have. I could have left that out and had 100% return on less, but the thing has done well. It's done better than most other things I own. So I'm kind of pleased with that. I'd rather have it be a bigger part and just see a slightly smaller number next to it. Okay, fine, we'll live with that. It has been very up and down as a business. I mean, it's hard to notice this as a stock when it's bouncing between 90% up and 75% up or whatever. It's still kind of significantly green number. If that thing ever goes red, I don't know quite what I'll do. Probably buy it, to be honest. But the dividend that we get, if we kind of look our way back through that history, has gone up and down a fair bit. And it's a US stock, sure, so there is a bit of kind of volatility from FX coming through. But if you look back through the kind of history on these sorts of things, dividends go sort of fairly up and down. I mean, they were good through 2023, but the one at the end of 2022 was a bit less high than it might have been before. But so, yeah, I think it's been doing kind of reasonably well. I'm very optimistic for it going forward in terms of staying up here and just continuing to chuck cash out as and when. And I expect ups and downs with the mining company, especially one obviously very closely tied to copper and a geography like Peru, which is decent but not entirely immune from any kind of unrest. So that's my highest, my worst performing stock in any portfolio, and it is strictly in my ISA, but I don't count it as part of my main ISA thing, is Realty Income, which is where I put all my premium bonds money, because I thought I'd prefer income to occasional wins. I should look at premium bonds again recently. That thing is down 15%, and that is with dividends reinvested, so there's nothing to add back from there. It's a really close run thing, by the way, with Realty Income, though. It is down 15%, and down 15% is the largest red number next to anything that I own. I'm not sure it's the biggest loss in terms of monetary amount, but let's go by percent here, because I think that was probably the question that was intended. It's actually down 21%, but being helped by a 6% FX swing. And that kind of exaggerates the gap, because the next biggest loss for mine is Forterra, which is down 14%. That's a UK stock, which has no FX thing going for it. Would I buy Forterra at these prices? Yep, probably. Would I buy Realty Income at these? Yep, because I buy it at everything, because that's what I do. It's a monthly dividend stock. There's no point doing anything else with it. But those are my two worst performers. I'm kind of fine with both of them. I mean, both are very obviously attached to buildings in terms of leasing them or building them. So it's not a massive surprise to see these things turning down, especially with news that inflation's higher, meaning construction is likely to be lower, meaning interest rates are likely to stay where they are, meaning property prices are going to come down, meaning construction is going to slow, and so on and so forth. Though I heard that UK mortgage rates were actually coming down slightly, possibly with people expecting rate cuts in ways they ought not to. But that, I think, is helping to kind of keep a lid on house price declines. So it'll be interesting to see quite what happens with the property market there. I wonder whether it's got a bit more of a tailwind than the stock market has in the UK, perhaps justifiably, perhaps not. But those are my biggest winners and losers. I always forget I own Southern Copper as well. I was just looking at Berkshire Hathaway and working out, right, how much is this thing? It's not up 70%, because it doesn't really go up 70%. I haven't owned it that long. It does keep moving forward, that one. And I have more money in it than I do in Southern Copper. But Southern Copper, my biggest, it's actually being impeded by a 2% FX headwind too, because it was a long time ago that we bought it. And Realty Income's got the worst, with a bit of a push the other way. I don't think anything really persuades me to do much with either of those, Steve. I think I like better in terms of my portfolio your idea of looking at cyclical things, figuring that there might be a chance, potentially anyway, to try and scale into some of these. I'm not keen on calling a bottom anytime soon because, well, it looks to me like people were trying to do that about a month ago and it didn't really work very well, because suddenly inflation comes in slightly high, everything starts heading to the downside again. But I think cyclicals are a good space to be looking in right now, especially with things having turned around a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'm with you there. I think cyclicals and REITs essentially is where I'm very tempted to put a lot of my money. I'm still sat on a decent chunk of cash. Getting the 5% interest from trading 2-on-2 at the moment helps to sit on cash, I think, just while you sort of like carefully weigh your decisions. But yeah, it does burn a hole in my pocket cash, and I am looking at these stocks now like Kering and like LVMH and thinking like, what would be the best move here? Because I have a feeling that perhaps not the, you know, soon to be will LVMH outperform cash, but over the next 10 years I'm almost certain that LVMH will outperform cash from here. So yeah, and you've got to remember that when interest rates come down, trading 2-1-2 are going to bring down those interest rates within a day's notice, it says in the T's and C's. So I'd be time to deploy, I think, Steve. I think I'm close to deploying here. Probably tomorrow it's going to be in. Let's just say that.
Well, so by the time this goes out, your cash will no longer be there. It'll be interesting to see what's happened then in that case. As you know, because we were chatting earlier today, I have been deploying today, not necessarily deliberately, but I set up some limit orders for stuff I thought I might buy, and then both of them set themselves off today because prices came into range. I got a bunch of other price alerts too going off. Pfizer's back down at 28 again. Unilever's down, Diageo's down. Plenty of stuff is making its way downwards to levels that I thought might be attractive, at least at some time I thought might be attractive. So it'll be interesting to see whether they kind of stay there or whether they start to come in lower. And I think with the stuff I've been buying, the lower I am in the case of the lower it goes, the more I like it right now, because I'm not feeling like I'm in a tearing hurry. I'd be quite happy scaling into these positions. And I guess the lower they go, if you're worried about portfolio balance, which I'm generally not, I'm okay with the idea that over time I expect my portfolio to grow in terms of me putting more money into it with an annual 20,000 contribution limit from a stocks and shares ISA. So I don't mind something. I think I've got years left of doing this, by the way. I'm not near retiring any point soon or stopping adding anytime soon. So I'm okay with the idea that bits might be stuck out a bit at the top here, because if I stick next year's allowance into something else, that will suddenly rebalance everything a bit better. Or if I just spread next year's out across a bunch of stuff that's down, that will suddenly move the percentages back to level. So at the moment, I'm kind of reasonably content with the idea of thinking that I'm all right with stuff in there. But even if you weren't that way minded, the more the thing goes down, the more of it you can buy without it occupying a huge amount of your portfolio is the way I guess I would look at that. If you want 5% of your portfolio in Kering, for example, and you get 5% of your portfolio in Kering, and then the thing falls through the floor, well, great, you can buy a load more of it and you still only have 5% of your portfolio in Kering. Cool. So opportunities by the sound of it.
Yeah, and it's like I said, there's nothing, I think it's exactly what you said, but there's nothing wrong with and I did this with a lot of positions, like Netflix when they collapsed, was just banging an awful lot of money into them, making them like second. I think it was my biggest position at one point, Netflix, and I banged a whole load of money in it. And then when it went back up 10-15%, I just trimmed that position back down to the size that I wanted it to be. And I think there are opportunities to do that now. I still feel that Disney's going to have a pretty good year. I mean, for all the things that all the calls that Disney's had an awful year at the cinema again. It had 3 of the top 10 films last year, Steve. So it's not the worst. I mean, it's not Disney normally has 4 or 5, but 3 for the worst year ever in Disney. Potentially interests me. In dumping some more money in there. And the same with Kering. I mean, you look at Kering's quarterly report versus just the quarter before. It's not that much worse. They're going to end up about level with how they did the year before, depending on how the second half goes. Is that warranting, you know, the decline in share price that they've had from top to toe? I think I was about 30% up to being 26% down. That's a big drop in share price for something that, you know, has delivered okay results. I mean, the growth isn't particularly great, but you're talking about a 10 PE, and you know, I don't think this is the end of growth for Kering. So I think pretty interesting here. There's loads of stuff you could do, Steve. It's just about figuring out in your brain what the best path is, I think.
Yeah, there's quite a lot you could do. I mean, to be clear, different shares behave in different ways, and there's quite a lot I wouldn't average down into if I owned it. Not mentioning any kind of hospital REITs in the US for the time being, but there's plenty of stuff that I've been looking at and seeing, oh, wow, I haven't looked at that in years, but when I looked at it, it was going really well. Two examples that kind of stand out to me at the moment are Oatly, the oat milk company whose shares have gone through the floor. And I sort of looked at their I looked at their finances. I looked at Yahoo Finance and typed in Oatly. I didn't look at them properly here. But when I look at them, I'm sort of not surprised why. I mean, this I have a kind of rule with them which says if you're going to buy an unprofitable company, and I don't mind buying unprofitable companies at all, but I need to know how they're going to get to profitability and have an idea of where I expect the cash flows to come from. And in the case of Oatly, they just haven't, from what I can see of it. They keep losing money, and now it's an expensive time to be losing money. And the stock is nearly dead as a result, as far as I can tell. It had a big old boost, and now it's down an awful lot. And then there's, well, I know it's one of your favorites, but Tattoo Chef is basically done, huh, as far as I can tell. As of, like, this is very old news. This is, like, last July's news, I think. But the thing is, pretty much had it. It had a bash at trying to carve out a space in supermarket aisles for itself when interest rates were low and credit was cheap and losing money wasn't very expensive business. But having sort of failed to do that, it feels like the kind of pressure's come on a little bit, and it turns out it's maybe not anti-fragile.
You can buy that whole company today, Steve, if you want it, for $8,370. Obviously, you'll be taking on a... probably some debt, but yeah, Tattooed Chef is a fairly cheap business if you wanted to go and buy outright today, Steve.
I could go and buy it. Turn it around. And then what? I couldn't turn it around, I think, is the main issue, but I could what? Hand it over to some bondholders, you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we could sell vegetable lasagnas to Costco.
Could we? I mean, is it straightforward? That people don't eat vegetable lasagnas where you're from, do they?
No.
They're probably eating where I am, but that's not a big enough market. It might be worth it for $8,000 or so. Maybe by next week we'll look at how much debt they've got, and we'll have a big crowdfunding round. And if anyone wants to join in, we'll try and buy Tattooed Chef if it hasn't got any debt, which it almost certainly has. But enough of this nonsense. Steve, we've kind of ruined that investing tortoise. Is first part of question. We'll come back to the second part of Investing Tortoise's question in a little bit, and I'll try not to mess that up quite as badly as I messed this one up. But Steve, have you consumed anything this week?
I have, yes. And so over Christmas, I think a couple of weeks before Christmas, keen-eyed viewers, or people who've watched more than one show, which is in the minority, will have noticed that I got Steve a Christmas present, and I got him a copy of The Fund, which is a book that I enjoyed whenever it came out. I was trying to figure this out off air, and I'm not sure. So I'm going to say a year ago, although I don't think it's that old. Written by an author called Rob Copeland, and it basically tracks the very, very beginnings of Raymond Dallaglio's life, and then his name changed to Dalio, and then the whole sort of idea behind Bridgewater up until... basically up until he retires at Bridgewater, it basically follows him. And the stories that come out of that hedge fund are crazy. He's mentioned Ray Dalio before, and he knows that I have a fairly negative opinion of him. And I think that once he reads this book, he'll fully understand why I have a negative opinion of him, because the book is really a tell-all of, and I mean, we're talking things like sexual harassment, just a belligerent man who can't accept he's wrong, a man who rules by fear, not the sort of man who stands on, a man who makes his staff have baseball cards about all their various attributes, including something called believability. And when he realizes that his believability is less than all of his staff members, rigs it so that he becomes the leader. But anyway, I say all that to say this. If you have a premium Spotify subscription, the book at the moment is currently free for you to watch on a premium Spotify subscription. You don't have to pay for it. So if you've got the music subscription, you get the Fund audiobook for free to listen to and all its chapters. And it's read by a man whose name I can't remember. But he has a very, very good voice for it. It's very entertaining. And I thought I would quickly shoot through it and just brush up on my... brush up on my brain to when Steve eventually wants to tell me about it, that I remember all the bits and pieces. And yeah, it was, to be fair, it's like reading the book again. I'm not into audiobooks really. I prefer to read it myself. But just the difference in inflection between the reader and when I was the reader has just made something sound even worse to me. So if it was possible for me to come out with a worse opinion of Ray Dalio and his underperforming funds, I've managed to come out with an even worse opinion of Ray Dalio. So I'm going to put a link to it in the description. And I wholeheartedly recommend that you check it out. You'll get through it in about 6 or 7 hours. So for me, it's just been a few drives and basically been sat at my desk, and I'm pretty much near the end of it. I think I'm on chapter 17 or 18 or something like that. So I'm right near the end. And yeah, it's thrilling stuff. Steve?
When we talk about consumption, we often make a big thing out of listening or reading or following or engaging with stuff that we disagree with because we think it's important to hear the other side of what we think. And hopefully we try and be as open-minded as we can and accept the possibility we might find what we read or hear or engage with and so on convincing. Because that's quite hard, right? To convince somebody that, oh, look, that thing you really thought was plausible was in fact not plausible. I think in some cases it can be equally hard to try and increase somebody's conviction in a thing that they are almost already certain of. And so despite your kind of consumption thing being basically the opposite of looking for things that you disagree with this week anyway, it's quite impressive that things that you somehow it's more impressive to increase your kind of confidence that Ray Dalio is not someone people ought to be paying attention to, because I didn't think that had any higher to go, especially not by material you've technically already covered once, I guess. And that's often the sign, by the way, I think, of a really, really good, let's say, book, audiobook, whatever, in this case, that it kind of keeps giving, right? It's there's something there for you on a second go round, on a third go round, on a fourth go round, and whatever and whatever. And the stuff just seems to keep being relevant and important and interesting and insightful and keeping, you know, giving you new reasons for, even though you've already seen them before, but new ways of thinking of, yeah, that's really important too. So yeah, interesting stuff. I'm getting around to it as soon as I can here, but I may also try and cheat and maybe do it chapter by chapter, reading some and listening to some. That sounds like quite an attractive way to go about it for me.
Yeah, and like I say, the chapters are pretty short as well. I think the longest one is about 30 minutes, so that's only a good walk, isn't it? So yeah, it's I'm just thinking about how he was talking about a staff member daring to joke with him about him predicting 15 of the last zero recessions and getting himself fired, which is just a brilliant line in there, because the inflection you get from the reader is just how you read it in your head and how it's read is just, it's just so much funnier when it's being read to you in the sort of like, it's almost a shock to the reader when he's reading it to you. You know what I mean? Like somebody would dare make a joke to Ray Dalio, the great Ray Dalio. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he doesn't like it. But I mean, this story is in there about how Ray Dalio refused to listen to experienced divers and almost got eaten by a great white shark. Just all sorts of debauchery and basically a lady. He found out that a female staff member was having or beginning to start a relationship with his then CEO, and he put them both on trial and couldn't, and there genuinely is trials in Bridgewater, and if he couldn't decide who who was to blame, but because the believability score of his CEO, despite the fact that the CEO has a lot of interactions with Ray Dalio, so whose score is rigged, so the CEO score is rigged, was artificially high, decided to go by that, and sack the lady, who obviously then went for a sexual harassment charge against Bridgewater and won, I think they said it was 3 years salary, and quite a bit more, and she was highly paid as well. She was a middle manager at the time, so, and Bridgewater at that point was just, you know, bringing in, I think I had said about 160 billion in assets under management or something at that kind of point. So they were raking a fair amount in fees and underperforming. And yeah, it's just crazy, Steve. It is, it's crazy stories. A lady had her, she was wearing a skirt, and a new male manager came in and put his hand on her knee. And Dalio just said, "I don't believe you." a bit. Essentially, the story says wicked, wicked things going on in that place, and it sounds like it was so dysfunctional and full of people who were terrified of Ray Dalio. But yeah, I think you'll like it. I recommend it. Check it out if you get time.
We'll put the link down below, but if anyone just wants the kind of Blinkist 5-minute summary of that book, you can just wind this podcast back a little bit. I sort of wondered whether I would need the link or whether you were just going to tell me everything that was in it. I'm really looking forward to getting into this one. I've consumed something much less interesting. So oftentimes when things go wrong with companies, I am unsure whether they are big problems or buying opportunities. And sometimes to try and find these things out, I attempt to figure out as much about a company as I can. And this reminds me of things that I've heard about companies from before. And a really good place for that is Business Breakdowns. So I've been back to the well recently, and I've been listening to the Business Breakdowns episode on Boeing, which has gone back to doing what Boeing does, which is having problems with MAX jets. In this case, the not a door has been falling off it, which is not what's meant to happen with these kind of things. But thinking about Boeing, and I don't know that much about it, share price is down from 260 to 210, not just because of that, but partly because of that off its kind of recent peak. So is there a buying opportunity here? I'm not sure, but the place I would go to find out is Business Breakdowns and get a real feel for how this company works. It feels like a lot of YouTubers, and I don't mean this critically because there are cases where I have been that person, and there may be again, but it's very easy to pull up a bunch of numbers, read them off, and say, here you go, stuff's going up, stuff's going down, stuff's looks like a worry, stuff doesn't look like a worry. You might think to an extent I was doing that with Wix when I was talking about interest coverage and so on. That's certainly part of it. But there's a lot more than just numbers going up and numbers going down, because companies might well be at a point where their numbers in the future are going to look quite different to their numbers in the past. And you want to know why one number is so different to all the other things. Was that a one-off thing, or is that something they ought to be interested in? Which number's the outlier, basically, if you have three quite different ones in the last 3 years? So figuring out how companies work, how they make their money, what it is that protects them is really, really good for these things. And for hearing about Boeing and thinking about it as not just a kind of manufacturing company, which it is, with a lot of intelligence, which it has, and there are only limited competitors and so on, and that's right. But thinking of Boeing and Airbus as kind of instruments of soft power as well, I'm not going to say government-backed, because that is always the predicate that you attach to something that is basically doomed. But thinking about Boeing as much, much more than a kind of builder of aircraft, and you can get past the basics on that quite quickly of what do? They build commercial aircraft. That's about 40% of their business. There's only one other organization that does this at any kind of scale. So it's a duopoly. It's slightly worse than a monopoly, but basically better than in anything else. That's all fairly straightforward, but the Business Breakdowns episode has an awful lot more going on in there. I won't spoiler it all for you because we have to kind of shift it along, but I think that's a really good place to be looking, partly for finding out about companies for general interest, but also when you hear specific things about share prices moving lower, well worth a look to kind of refresh yourself. I would say user beware a little bit with this sort of thing, because and this is in pretty much every way a compliment, but also a warning. It's often the case that I leave Business Breakdowns thinking, I want to go buy that thing, whatever it is, whether it's Coke or Boeing or Diploma or London Stock Exchange Group or Schwab or pretty much anything for that matter. The people who talk about these things, they know stuff about them. They are generally investors in those companies. And so, look, you would expect them to say good things about them. That's not them talking their book. I think it's the other way around here. I think they have strong views that these companies are worth owning and therefore own them. You would find it kind of weird for to have people who say, yeah, look, this company is really great. Do you own it? No. There's a good question of why not. Maybe price, but otherwise, I don't think so. So, yeah, Business Breakdowns. I've been listening to the one on Boeing. I think it's a really interesting place to go looking when you see a falling share price and trying to figure out whether that falling share price is justified or not.
I agree with that completely, and the way you feel about it when you come out of it as well. They have a way of making you want to buy even the most random things that you stumble across. I tweeted out in the middle of the week, Steve, that, and I think I sent it to you as well, but I said that I thought Buffett should stop messing around with that big old pile of cash and just go out and buy Boeing. it is a Buffett kind of business in the way that I think about Buffett kind of businesses. It's not a monopoly, but it is a sort of duopoly in that market. And I know Airbus is smashing it from pillar to post, but I would say that's more like Buffett's opportunity. I think this is kind of what he did when he went around picking up railroads a few, well, probably a few hundred years ago. But is it a thing? Could Buffett buy Boeing? He doesn't need to know anything about that business. He just needs a good manager in charge of it, doesn't he?
Probably. You kind of hinted at the reason that I think he hasn't. I went looking into this after you sent it to me because I didn't see your tweet. I seem to see everything you put on the Trading 212 forum, which is why my phone is constantly blowing up during the working day. And one of the reasons that I'm already behind at work after 4 days worth of input. Worth it, though. Just so I can prod the up thing when someone else has got cross at you. But the Buffett and Boeing thing, I went looking into this afterwards because I thought it made a lot of sense. Buffett, I think, when you look at what the big investments are, they are, I think, first and foremost, things with recognizable moats. Ideally, he always says that it's a company that's not capital intensive, but look, he owns an awful lot of businesses that are capital intensive. A railroad's really capital intensive. Utilities companies are really capital intensive. What you get from them is very well protected returns because no one's going to build another railroad and there's not going to be more than one outfit building transmission lines in the same place, right? So if you own that asset, that infrastructure, it's yours and you probably don't have to worry about competition very much. You have to worry about regulation, but not competition. So you have a moat of a sort, a kind of anti-competitive moat here. So does Boeing have to worry about competition? Not massively. I mean, there is Airbus does compete with them, but one of the things I heard from the breakdowns thing was that, look, once these things are ingrained, the switching costs are actually quite high for airlines. If you think of something like a Ryanair or a Southwest, one of their things that makes them cheap is that they run one type of aircraft. They run one type of aircraft, and that way you only have to train your pilots on one type of aircraft. If you want to switch from Boeing stuff to Airbus stuff, you have to retrain them all. So that makes there's a cost to doing that, right? Which, rather than shouting at Boeing to get their act together a little bit and start building better planes, that's better for everyone concerned if you can manage that. So the reason that I figured, having tried to do some Googling, is that Buffett feels like he can't adequately estimate what the demand will look like for air travel long term. I'm surprised by this from someone who has relatively recently, certainly recently in the scheme of a life as long as his, been off buying a cross-section of US airlines. Seems to me like someone who's reasonably bullish on this sort of thing. So I could see it happening. I would be surprised if it happened, but I wouldn't be incredulous. And they are involved in the kind of airline space with stuff like NetJets and so on. So, I wouldn't mind seeing Boeing as a Berkshire subsidiary. I am a Berkshire shareholder. I think it could be well worth buying. I'm not buying it myself, mind you. So there's what you could do with it if you had Berkshire's cash and network and sources of income and so on. And what you could do with it if you were me. And the list of stuff you could do with it if you were me is cross your fingers, basically, and maybe follow it. And the stuff you could do with it if you owned it as part of a conglomerate, you would be well away on that, plausibly, I think. It would be one of their bigger holdings. I can't think how it would map in terms of market cap likely with stuff like a railroad. I think it would be a lot bigger. But no, it's within the range of what can be done with their current cash, I think. So, yeah, interesting stuff. I can see time running on here. So maybe we bracket Investing Tortoise's other question for next week. But we'll carry on with the last part of our show, which is part two of the trilogy, Steve.
It's actually part three of the trilogy, Steve, because part two, I stumbled across some worrying things about the business. So that one might get shelved, so it might end up only being a two-part series, but we'll
see. Part three of the two-part series.
But yes, part three of the two-part series. There's your title. This is a pretty interesting company. It was taken into private equity in 2017, and it's already been spat back out. And I don't think that's because it's a particularly terrible business or anything like that. I think it's quite an interesting business here. I think it's perhaps a little bit expensive. We mentioned it to a friend of the show off air, and that was his initial remark as well, that he thought that it was a bit expensive. It is less expensive than it was, but I'll just quickly run through it and see what you think. So the company is called Clearwater Analytics, and the ticker, I believe, is CWAN, so CWAN. And it's a software company that provides automated investment accounting. So things like performance, compliance, risk reporting services for sort of institutional investors, insurance companies, asset managers, banks, and sort of government pension schemes. So had a quick look through the customers. They include companies like T. Rowe Price, Saga, the DC government, Meta, Aviva, and a smallish outfit called JP Morgan. They essentially help these organizations manage their sort of vast investment portfolios by sort of aggregating the data from a number of sources. So this includes things like custodians all around the world, different investment managers, different brokers, different order management systems. They sort of reconcile and validate the data to make sure it's accurate and up to date. And then they generate a whole load of reports and analyses off the back of these. And these reports can be used to track performance, make more investment decisions, and generally to comply with sort of complex regulation all around the world. It's completely cloud-based, which means that anybody using the software can access their data and reports from anywhere in the world, and that makes it a really popular choice for somebody like JP Morgan, who has sort of global operations. So at the moment, the vast majority of systems that compete with this are run on sort of a patchwork of both hand-built and bought-in solutions, and they need armies of people to run them and update them. This can be quite rigid software. It doesn't always meet companies' needs properly. It can be slow, expensive, and in many cases involves manual updating, which obviously runs the risk of introducing human error into the mix. So Clearwater are having a lot of success addressing this. They reckon that about 91% of reconciliation is now fully automatic across their full client base. And this has led to a large uptick in users. They've got about 13,000 users at the moment, about 6.4 trillion in assets under management by the system. So doing pretty well. In terms of financials, it's a pretty interesting bit because it's all swapping around at the moment. They're adapting to a new change. So their original model was essentially tied to trying to charge a small fee based on the assets under management they managed on behalf of the clients. And this was fine in heady times when stocks and a lot of their portfolio that they manage is bonds, which obviously could only go up or stay roughly similar. But they learned quickly during COVID and in 2022 that this probably wasn't the best model. When everything takes a hit, it makes your sales really unpredictable and volatile, and that's not really something that you want to build a fast-growing business on. So they've transitioned to what they call a base plus model, and this is charging clients a base fee that it can increase annually if it needs to, plus there's some incremental fees for increases in assets and adding supplemental services, which limits its downside and its sales and gives a sort of clearer path for investors to plot growth. So this one went public in 2021. It went up 41% on its first day of trading, Steve, but I seem to remember a lot of stuff sort of did that around 2021. But like all public software companies, it's kind of struggled since then. And it's about 21% lower than its initial close, and that equates to about 4.8 billion in market cap. So looking across the details, that gives you about 303 million in revenue, which is growing 20% per annum. It gives you a 72% gross margin, which nets out to an 8 million loss. This company is very much in the growth at all sorts, all costs phase of their business cycle. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that now. They generated about 50 million of free cash flow last year, and they've generated about 72.5 million of free cash flow in the trailing 12 months. So they're very comfortably free cash flow positive, which at least gives you something to work from. They've got 256 million in cash and cash equivalent, so they've got plenty of runway if you are worried about that 8 million loss. The one slight issue there is a decent chunk of SBC at the moment due to an acquisition last year. They acquired a French company called Jump. Trailing 12 months at the moment, if you factor in all the SBC they've had to pay as that part of that acquisition, it's about a third of revenue. But it's normally only around a fifth. There's still a lot, though, at the moment. It's definitely one to keep an eye on. But I don't think it's the end of the world just yet. They've got about $50 million in long-term debt, so that's under a year's free cash flow, so I'm not particularly worried about that. I think they're on the way to having a bit of a moat, though. I think the complexity of the sort of problem they're trying to solve and their integration with many different data sources, it makes it kind of expensive and time-consuming for clients to switch to another provider. So I think there's an element of switching costs there. I also think there's network effects in there as well. As more clients use Clearwater, the platform becomes more valuable for all clients. It's because they can aggregate more data and provide better analytics across, you know, how things are faring against other items. There's a little bit of brand recognition in there. It's quite a well-known brand within the investment industry. There's quite a few comments from JP Morgan on there saying that they've been so impressed with just how good this system is at tying together all the assets that they've allowed it to track. But the other sort of miniature moat, I would say, is just the ability for it to provide regulatory compliance. I think the platform sort of helps people comply with complex regulations such as Solvency II and the AIFMD, which is the Alternative Investment Fund Managers Directive. That's a really, really valuable service, which is very, very difficult for people to comply with at the moment and provide the right kind of documentation. So I guess my arguments against it being a strong moat, why I'm saying I think it's a weak moat at the moment, is I think they're going to have a little bit of competition here. I think the market for investment account software is becoming quite competitive. And I've had a quick look through the market, and I think there's new players entering the market all the time. And there's a couple that have been bought by private equity recently as well. So it is a bit tricky on that front. I think there's a technology risk as well here, that the platform is based on a complex technology. And if they fail to keep up the latest trends, if they fail to keep up with the latest regulatory guidance, then they're going to be vulnerable to disruption from somebody who does. And again, they've got some massive clients in there, which make up quite a large portion of their total customers. So if somebody like JP Morgan was to switch off Clearwater, and there's no signs that they're going to do that at the moment, but that would have a big impact on Clearwater's business. So I ran it through the reverse DCF, Steve, which that spits out that you're going to need about 25% growth over the next 10 years if you factor in the dilution, if it continues on the way that they are doing. And if you take the last quarter's figure, Steve, we're growing at 24%. So we're actually not a million miles away, but we are short. So I would say that it's borderline achievable from here. If you get a couple of dollars off the price, then you're going to get to the 23.7% growth that we've got at the moment. You've got to think that that's either going to continue. I think there's potentially a reason for it to accelerate here as more and more customers come on board. So I'm tempted to wait for it, Steve, to come down to about $14, which is about $5 off the price, about 25% further down from here. And that would imply 20% growth year on year, which I think seems really achievable. Bearing in mind as well, obviously, that these companies tend to have really good operating leverage. So the more they grow, the faster that money flows down to the bottom line, because it's not like an industrial way, you have to hire more and more men to fulfill demand. This is really a one and done kind of thing. So these companies, if they can get 20% growth for 10 years, don't be surprised to see buybacks and things like that really quickly becoming a reality, because they tend to have a lot of operating leverage, they generate a lot of cash, and they really struggle for ways to spend it meaningfully. That's a company that's on my watch list of things to watch at the moment. I think it's a really interesting business. It's in a sector that I don't have anybody in at the moment. And I'd be interested to hear what everybody thinks about it.
Small quibble here, actually. I was looking at it while you were speaking. I have a lower market cap than you do that I'm reading on FinViz at the moment. They have it at $4. They have a similar share price to you. You said $5 down would take you to about 14 or so, you were saying, I think. So they've got 19.3 as their closing share price from today, the 18th. They think that gets you to a market cap of $4 billion. I'm not sure how you set your reverse DCF up. But if you set it with a market cap or that you typed in, or if you had it pulled the market cap from somewhere, you'd probably be fine. But you may be closer to a go than you thought on that one, is one small wonder that I had here. 25% does sound like a challenge to me at this point. I note that Price to free cash flow is around 55, and we're looking at about 10 times sales. So I do think that margin has some room to grow. A lot of the stuff you said there sounded familiar from software as service companies in various different ways. Yeah, they don't need to add a lot more people in order to kind of help push their growth out. Their cost of growth, their capital intensity for growth is pretty low, or growth capex is going to be very low. Interestingly, their customers aren't going to need that many people around either if they're going to kick out all their compliance people, which is presumably part of the kind of value proposition. It's easier, it's cheaper, and it's more reliable. So I definitely see that point. I was looking through it. I also thought debt wasn't a problem here. So it's an interesting time to be looking at these kinds of businesses, especially if you think about the last week or so that we've been seeing, that maybe interest rates aren't coming down as quickly as we thought here. That drives people towards dividend stocks generally, and it's not crazy and it's not hard to see why, because prices come down, dividend yields go up, some of them look quite attractive, quite reasonably so. I think there's nothing the matter with that as a way of thinking. It's true of me in some cases, not others, but anyway, there's good opportunities to look through the stuff the market is leaving behind, and that is in some cases tech, in some cases not. Anything with a kind of edge on AI has been hardly left behind. I mean, in some cases, it's been tearing away faster than everything else. But I think this is a good time to be looking in this kind of space. I said that about quite a few things this show. But secular growing things that are have a few kind of quite specific characteristics, so this isn't a sector bet, that are not in danger of bankruptcy, put that way. And one way of being that way is free cash flow positive, cash on hand, and debt under control. So that all sounds fine. If this is going to be okay and you see a share price coming down, there might be some growth headwinds from higher interest rates and people being slow to kind of convert and so on and move away from their different things while they're trying to batten down the hatches. Possibly. If you can get this cheap enough, that doesn't really matter, is my probable takeaway from this. The moat in terms of switching costs, I could have probably told you. That makes a lot of sense to me. And in that sense, I think there is a good reason to, you said there are quite a few companies competing in this, and this makes sense to me as to why Clearwater are in growth at all costs, as you put it, mode, right? You need to get people into that. Network, if you think there's a network effect, that it was news to me. But if you think there is a kind of network there, you need to get people into it, because once they're in, they will benefit from being in, they will make your network stronger. But it will be hard to get them out of someone else's. So it seems like it's kind of a race here, right? To grab as much market share as you can, and the profitability will come afterwards. We've seen this in countless other businesses. The risk with these, as I see it anyway, is that the profitability doesn't damn well come. And I don't think that's going to be the case with ClearLake, because the kind of businesses I tend to worry about, and here's the reason I'm not investing in semiconductor stocks at the moment, is I'm not convinced any of them has a good enough moat that will allow them to sit still and pay shareholder returns at any given moment. It feels to me like people are constantly innovating, constantly driving forwards, constantly investing, constantly spending, constantly pushing the envelope, and everybody has to do it or they get crushed. And the biggest, the most obvious kind of example of that is Intel, who got themselves way, way, way ahead, bigger R&D spend, bigger everything else than everybody else, but started doing share buybacks and dividends and got overtaken. Basically. So their moat disappeared pretty darn fast, and they went from having what looked like every advantage to having no advantage at all. And if things change hands that easily, I worry that they change back quite easily. I don't see that being the case here. So high switching costs and an impressive network effect and so on, they look to me like kind of durable competitive advantages. When I think about these kind of race to grab market share things, it hadn't better be the case that hanging on to that market share costs you a lot, but I don't think it will with Clearwater. So I think this is sort of interesting for that reason. If you can get it at the right price, which might not be terribly far away, and well worth a look, is my sort of thought on that one.
I'm going to have to calc it myself, because I pulled it off Google Finance, to be honest with you, so being lazy. $4.71 billion is what they're saying. Interestingly, though, Reuters is saying 4.8. ROIC.ai is saying 3.93. And Yahoo Finance has gone for 5.3 or 7. So, yeah, I feel like there's a lot of people getting confused over this. So I'll have to calc it myself, which is a lesson in investing there, to never trust your go-to Google Finance sheet at 6 o'clock when you're writing this.
Yeah, so maybe one for the weekend. If you count up all the shares one by one and then multiply them by the market the share price, that'll give you that at least. It'll take you a couple of days to count to that many with your fingers and toes and stuff, but that's... that's probably, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the kind of market cap of that is. I guess you'd need to look at NASDAQ or wherever it's listed is probably going to be the most reliable place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I would have thought that ROIC.AI has always been very, very accurate for me. So
I thought they were all fine when it came to stuff like market cap, which isn't a terribly complicated thing, right? I mean, when you're stuff like Yahoo Finance and you're trying to pull accounts and convert them into categories that Yahoo Finance understands, I can see why you get mistakes, and things like Apple's debt doesn't look right to me on there. But where it's, as it were, just the market cap, that doesn't seem like a kind of thing that websites ought to be getting wrong. So comment down below, where do you look for inaccurate information about companies? Because at least some of these are wrong. It's not got every one of those as a market cap. It might have one of them, but do you happen to know which one? Let us know. That'd be nice as well. Anyway, Steve, that pretty much it for today's show.
That's it, yeah.
Great. In that case, we will see you all next week. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll probably tackle Investing Tortoise's question plus some other stuff. Bye for now.